So between now and let's say 20 minutes from now, and then Phil will get the last 5 minutes, what we figured we'd do is just in reconvening everyone is to have each of the breakout groups welcome Doc Searles. I saw you were here on Twitter. That's good news. Come back to the group, but not with the sort of desultory, here's what our group discussed comments, which tend to drag at the end of the day, but rather to have reports from each group on very specific action items that seemed interesting or plausible based on that conversation. It may be some groups may have more of these action-oriented things than others. Amr Asher over here is taking notes on that, and we're going to create a wiki page that will try to roll up all of the things that stand out to us as actionable. Here's how you could get involved of the Eric Saltzman variety. If you're an author, here's how you could participate in the fairness hearing, for instance, and then try to give some real specifics around that. So maybe we could start with Mark Rotenberg group. I see him over there. If either Mark or somebody in that group might want to report out any actionable items, and then we'll go to Ethan/Peter's group on research in non-consumptive and consumptive research. We'll do third, the one that was in here, which started out as a pricing conversation, ended up as an open access discussion. Even without you here, Peter, amazingly enough, we got around to open access. And then last, John's, which may or may not have that quality to it. We'll find out in a second. Mark.
Okay. Well, thanks. I'll make a... Is this on? Yes. You can hear me, right?
But I think there may be webcasters, in which event, please do keep talking into it. And you just check that it's on. I don't think it projects much, but at least it's channeling.
It doesn't really sound on, but it
is on.
I would just believe that it's
okay,
on.
Okay, and I'm not trying to protect my privacy.
Everything you say is being recorded.
I do want to be heard. So I'll just make a brief summary, and if there are other people who participated who would like to add stuff, that would be great. We did talk about how there was a rich tradition of protecting privacy in the library world, and how some of that was in the practice of the information librarians kept or did not keep. Some of that was in the laws that safeguard the information that's protected. Some of it is even found in the court's cases concerning the Constitution, the right to speak anonymously, and in some circumstances the right to receive information anonymously. But as our discussion progressed, we began to realize also that in the digital world, much has changed. A lot more information is kept for many different purposes, and that's created some new risks. And then we realized that even in this new digital world, there are also new privacy safeguards. And I think over in Harkness, if you look at the public terminals, there are signs that actually say, no personal information is retained from session to session, which means that there's now a practice of routinely clearing cookies and caches and everything else, and we thought that was very interesting. We looked at a couple of different examples to try to imagine how new privacy safeguards might apply in our idealized online digital world, and we considered in the realm of public domain information, which, by the way, includes not only the 18th century stuff, but all the current stuff that's generated by government agencies that helps inform the public. And it's enormously important to keep that category of information in mind as we think about privacy, because we might, in fact, want that information to be widely available without any kind of recording of activity, which actually led to one of our first conclusions. There may be a lot of activity that could be made freely available, a lot of information, without recording any personally identifiable information. And then we talked about categories of information, for example, properly within copyright, where you may need some mechanisms to compensate authors. And then we explored new technical methods that make it possible, payment schemes, for example, to enable cash transactions without revealing identities. So we were looking at new approaches, trying to map the traditional safeguards for privacy in the physical world into this new digital world, and we came up with a few ideas that we think could be incorporated at some point in the discussion.
Great. Thank you so much, Mark. One question coming across the Twitter stream was, is the live stream back up? And is it should be? All right. If it doesn't seem to be, and you're out there, I guess there's no way you'd know that I was saying this, so I'll have to send a Twitter. So I realize the fallacy of my logic. Sorry about that. We'll figure it in 1 second. Others, it's going. Okay. Others from Mark's group who want to point to actionable things that you heard and or suggestions that will go on the wiki semi-permanently, so. No other things. All right, let's move. Oh, yes, please. Yes, and if we could grab a mic, get that going, that'd be great.
Europe is not new to this complex layering of privatized information and public information, and that would help us not have to reinvent the wheel looking at some of those models. In particular, in the health arena, there are layers, and 23 contact points, for example, if you get anything paid. So that's complex, and it's not something we have to do from scratch, and it's something that's extremely urgent with this healthcare bill. Second point is there's an MIT yearly encryption conference, and looking at the participants and speakers for that is a good resource, even in between the conferences. There's also the Harvard and MIT each have a security and privacy office that has a seminar series.
Great, thank you. And let's actually, if we can, just switch to the other mic, so I think this one is getting some reverb to it. Great, so let's go to the second session. Ethan, as you were walking in, the charge here was to focus not on a general recap, if possible, but actionable specifics that one might take out of this conversation that you guys had.
Sure, we had the good fortune of having one of those classic sessions where the people in front of the room were probably the least knowledgeable on the subject.
I can't believe if you were at the front of the room that was true.
In a room full of people who knew this material really well, we had a volunteer rapporteur who I'm going to hand over to.
Excellent. All right, Mackenzie, good deal.
So just a few words of background. One is that superficially the research corpus seems like a win-win-win-win-win. Right, but the truth is that the market potential for it is in many ways bigger than the book collection per se, because if it could help solve problems with machine translation, for example, that's a multi-billion dollar market. So there are some issues with it that we have to keep in mind. And just the sort of facts of the matter are that Google will have a copy of the corpus, and so will up to two research institutions that they're working with that have not yet been identified. And the settlement's very vague about a lot of the specifics compared to other aspects, like exactly what you can do with the data and what non-consumptive research means. And you know, so it's very specific about certain things, like the fact that you can't commercialize what you do with the corpus. So for example, if you use it to develop derivative works that you want to then resell, you can't do that. So really, the low-hanging fruit there is with better language models, better frequency models, things that will improve algorithmic access to this kind of information. So the big concern here is that the universities that choose to host this corpus are accepting legal and financial liability for making sure that the terms of that settlement are enforced. So if I were Harvard, I'd be a little nervous about accepting that liability, given that it's very hard to control what researchers do in the wild. So there is a fear that the two research institutions that end up hosting this will turn into like the Large Hadron Collider of text research, where the access gates are very high. And in fact, only members of that institution, like if Harvard hosted it, then Harvard researchers could have access to it. And that could cause, in fact, a research crisis if not enough people have access to it to reproduce research results and so on. So it's really going to be very important to make sure that at least Google's copy have some degree of open access, maybe very limited access, like 10,000 queries a day or something. We talked about various ways you could define that. But if at least Google provides that to anybody who wants it, then the other two institutions could have a slightly freer hand to provide more broad access that's higher risk. But the other issue is for the original partner institutions who have copies of a lot of this data, we don't know what terms and conditions they can release their copies for research, non-consumptive use. So for example, Michigan with Hoppe Trust, what can they do with their copies of the data already, irregardless of the settlement? So that's just a big question, because Harvard, for example, did only public domain works. So in theory, they should be able to release those as a research corpus, no matter what the settlement says. And that itself might be quite useful. So that was about it.
Thank you, Mackenzie.
So actually, can I respond?
Yeah, that'd be great.
That were made here. So
did it go over the threshold?
Did it go over? Yes, it did. So in terms of kind of commercial exploitation, you know, of the research corpus. So taking machine translation. So you picked the perfect example there, right? So the research corpus, you basically think of it as kind of, you know, free play for anyone in, you know, who wants to do any sort of data mining. And a non-consumptive use is basically something that isn't a substitute for reading the work, unless it's a computer doing the reading of the work. So let's imagine someone uses the research corpus to make some advances for natural language translation, thus competing with Google, or to develop new search algorithms. What they could do, and it is explicitly outlined in the settlement, is they can commercially exploit the algorithms. So if you use the research corpus to develop new technology, you can sell that technology, and Google gets none of it. What you can't do is use it to create derivative work. So for machine translation, what you can't do is to say, all right, here are 8 million or 20 million books that are in this corpus. What we're going to do is some external company, we're going to start translating those and selling those translations. That they can't do. What they can do is build a business around the algorithm that they have.
Great. Mackenzie, please take the mic just so we get it on the webcast.
For example, in the semantic web arena, you've got new initiatives like the Concept Web Alliance that want to build giant triple stores of information linking data. And it's not a translation, but you could consider it a derivative work. So it's not an algorithm. You know, it's in this fuzzy area, and who decides whether that's legit or not?
So we'll always have interesting questions about what constitutes a derivative work. So one of the things we've done inside Google is we've calculated n-grams for n equals 1 through 5 of the entire corpus of, you know, books that have been published. So, you know, a 1 gram is what are the most common words. 2 grams are what are the most common pairs of words. And these are really fascinating. We've been able to use them internally to be able to kind of date passages based on not what we know about the publication date, but by looking at the styles of language. And so we have this, and you know, we, you know, look forward to being able to share that data. That clearly is not a derivative work. That is a non-consumptive use, and that is something that we want to be able to give to the world for free. You also made a point about liability. And it's true, right? Any university or other institution who signs up to host the research corpus, yeah, there are, you know, financial penalties if they, you know, end up, you know, being negligent and that data ends up going out there. In defense of the settlement, think about it this way. We're taking the world's books. We're taking 10 million books. We're putting them, you know, think of it as we're bundling them into a station wagon. People are very nervous about where that station wagon may end up going. And so it's, you know, I wasn't involved in the negotiation of the settlement, but it does make sense that there are provisions in there to make sure that data is kept secure. And one of the ways that that is enforced is by having financial penalties if that data gets out there.
I think maybe a parting shot, and then I know John is going to want to go over to another group, is that we ended up concluding that there's clearly been an enormous amount of discussion and thought about authors' rights, publishers' rights, payment. The vast bulk of the settlement goes through the incredible complexity of that. There are at least as interesting questions around the research corpus, and it doesn't seem like there's been as much done around it. And one of the things that I worry about a little bit, John, is that you're right. I mean, there's no way that we can spell out what all the uses are. We're left with sort of two possibilities. One is to say that Google in good faith is trying really hard to let research go forward, but ultimately that responsibility for making sure that the station wagon doesn't go to Tijuana is going to be on the shoulders of universities. And those universities can often be incredibly hyper-cautious entities. And so I think one of the things that sort of came out of this...
Who are you calling hyper-cautious?
You, John Palfrey.
I know.
So I think one of the questions that came out of this was, is there an ability to have some sort of ongoing process to figure out what is in fact a non-consumptive use to reassure universities that they don't have to tie this down to the most absolutely non-transformative machine translation uses, for instance, but can start getting into places where we agree that access to n-grams is something that we have to do. But I don't think that's going to be obvious to a university general counsel. I don't know a lot of university general counsels that know an n-gram when it bites them. So
great. So John, here's the deal. I'd love it if you can respond to Ethan / Mackenzie, assuming this is again over the threshold. But then we may as well segue into the comments from your group. Does that make sense? If
sure.
There's anything you wanted to report out or others.
Well, they actually blend together because I think I have my actionable item right there, uh-huh. which is figure out a way by which we can kind of get pre-approval for certain sorts of non-consumptive uses. So to me, there will be some uses that are like clearly non-consumptive and, you know, even the most conservative lawyer should feel that, of course, this is going to be okay. And I think there will be hundreds of uses that fall into that category. There will be some that are clearly not okay, right? So machine translation and then, you know, selling the translated books, that's clearly not okay. There's going to be stuff in between. And so I think I want to make it something that I do to figure out how it can be communicated to researchers what is okay and what is not.
That'd be great. And using Ethan Z at just about anything will be a good proxy for getting something sensible.
Yeah. All right, great. And so, you know, now I'm supposed to talk about actionable items from...
and others can jump in, of course.
Yeah, from my session. Obviously, I'm in a strange position here, you know, being a representative of Google and just, you know, having this breakout session in which I just ask people to ask me anything about Google.
Did any tomatoes come forward?
No, I can just give my recap. No, we all agree that everything Google has ever done or will ever do is A-OK.
Perfect, right. Yep. If only Rotenberg had been in the room, he might have said something about privacy, but too bad.
He was also. Never privacy. Yeah. Never.
Yeah. He's got little bumper stickers over there.
What's so Siva, what's my mantra? Privacy is very important to us. So it was a wide-ranging discussion, so it wasn't as tightly focused as the other breakout groups. It jumped from topic to topic. Since you asked for not a recap, but kind of what we're going to take out of this and do differently, I'll kind of put a personal mark on that of, you know, I hear loud and clear that we need to figure out a way to kind of give public interest groups and libraries a voice. I believe that we were going to do that anyway. Google clearly needs to be clearer in how that is going to take shape in the years to come should the settlement be approved. So it's kind of vague, I suppose, when I phrase it that way. But
your session didn't lend it to much more, I would say, in the actionable thing, but that's very helpful.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Google is, it's one thing for me to say that Google is going to look out for libraries' interests. I know it's true because I'm me, but that doesn't mean that other people should trust me. And I need to figure out a way to earn that trust.
Excellent.
Sound fair?
Well put.
That's
good. Yeah. Excellent.
Build constraints on to prevent exorbitant pricing of the subscription.
So Bob Darnton, can I?
Yeah, of course.
I'll repeat his
that's
point
a good one.
For the webcast.
Yeah.
So Bob Darnton said, there is one thing you can do, build in constraints for institutional pricing. Done. So here is kind of how that's going to work. So for institutional pricing, I know it's something that you're concerned. I believe you you called us cocaine dealers on NPR. I want to say crack dealers.
Was it cocaine pricing?
I want to say crack dealers, but you are a very eloquent man. So I want to say purveyor of fine cocaine products. So Bob made the very good point that, you know, any of you who are in the library community and know about how some scientific journals are priced know that it's not a very good situation. Bob is right to ask, how are we going to know that Google isn't going to do that? Here are some answers. All right. So the first answer is that the settlement agreement explicitly, which if approved will constitute a court order, requires us to price for broad access. If we do not do that, we can be sued, and I hope successfully. That was recorded. Oh, God.
Sure was.
I just dug myself a hole. So, you know, the second
just because Alex McGilvray is leaving for Twitter, it doesn't mean they were
right. So the second answer is that it would be fairly silly. It would be economically irrational of Google to price this at too high an amount, because if we do that, competitors will come along. Option. So answer number three, and this is kind of a subtle one that I think a lot of people miss, is that we're not releasing just this one institutional product. We are releasing several products, one of which is individual consumer sale. So, and one of the things I want to do is start talking to libraries, to MIT, to Harvard, to figure out what prices are actually fair here. But if we did that cocaine pricing that you're talking about, what any sane library would do is to say, you know, that costs too much. And maybe, maybe what we should do is to figure out how to purchase books individually. We will give budgets to our departments to authorize individual consumer sales. Now, those individual consumer sales are not prices that we get to set. Those are set by the market over time. And we've seen that as more and more content becomes available online, that tends to exert a downward pressure on prices. So if we charge that cocaine amount, then you will simply say to the heads of your departments, you tell me what individual books you want. My fourth answer is one that will probably hold no sway with most of you, but it is that I'm going to be working on this for the rest of my life. I'm going to be the one having to defend the prices that we end up charging, and I don't have the constitutional makeup to defend prices that I don't think are fair. So those are my four answers.
All right, pretty good. Who else in the waning moments here? Anybody was in that session with John that wanted to point out actionable things for the wiki? No? All right. So maybe we go to our last session. Bob, are you willing to be the spokesperson for open access? We started, as I noted, with a conversation oriented toward the changing in prices that libraries are paying based on a system of acquiring an object and sticking in a shelf or a repository down the street, to a world in which we either pay, in essence, to lease rather than own, or to pay by the drink, which we got implications of it here from John's comment. And we ended up very quickly in an open access conversation, and I tried to get us out of an open access conversation, love open access as I do, and I couldn't. So that's where we stayed. So Bob Darton.
Actually, that's a very good summary of things, so I would pass the buck back to you. But I guess I should explain that I think most of the people in our group were involved with libraries and were very concerned with the terrible pressure on library budgets. We did not use the word cocaine, but...
Didn't come up once. I was there, too.
Everyone, I think, has seen her or his libraries suffer from the exorbitant prices charged by journals. So there was a lot of discussion of the whys and the whats of the journal charges and what justified this, what is its history, is there anything one can do about it? So it was a kind of exploratory discussion in general with a lot of collective wringing of hands because of a sense of impotence in the face of the enormous pressure for serials in library budgets. We then shifted, as John said, to a discussion of open access for journals in particular, and the possibility of reversing the model for journal pricing. That is to say, it's something we are seriously considering at Harvard, of actually subsidizing what we call processing fees. What some journals call them author's fees. But the idea would be to provide a subsidy with a cap to every author from within a particular faculty of a scholarly journal that was intended to go to an open access scholarly periodical. We calculate that this actually could be feasible and could, we hope, begin to set in motion a general drift towards open access publishing in scholarly journals. There are, of course, objections to this proposal. One is only wealthy universities could afford to pay such subsidies. But the plan actually has a provision in it for subsidizing journal articles that would come from less wealthy institutions, including third world countries and so on. So we're beginning to actually look hard at the economics of this. The general idea is if we can mobilize enough institutions to pay these kinds of processing fees, this will be a tremendous impetus towards open access publishing on the part of journals, and that, once it takes place, it's already taking place, but if it can be sped up, that then would actually undercut, in the long run, the journal publishers who charge exorbitant prices and maybe create a general shift to a world in which the costs are borne at the production end rather than the consumption end. So there was a discussion of that. We didn't come up with anything really spectacular by way of plausible action steps. I gather that's on our agenda, except this. I mean, I think if you could consider this as a possibility, discuss it with people involved, and see if in your home institutions there's any opening for this kind of action, it would all be to the good.
I think, and I would just put a sharper point on it, I think we started with a conversation about this difficulty we're facing as libraries with a perfect storm of various things, including rising prices and the need to provide more services and more materials. And very clearly, the group said the most, I mean, the conversation spoke for itself, that working on open access, mandating it, the various things that Peter Suber is working on, and then implementing it, are the most important things to break the chain that we're experiencing. Seemed to me perfectly clear.
So that really was the burden of the conversation. I mean, there were some new things, at least to me. One was the problem of metadata that comes along with purchasing of all kinds of sets of data sets or whatever they might be. And I think there is also the problem of prestige. That is to say, the way career patterns exist, especially in the hard sciences, that almost compel younger researchers to publish in these exclusive and very expensive periodicals. We did not find a way around that, but it was remarked, and as I'm sure many of you know, that there are more citations to open access journals than there are to the very exclusive high prestige journals. So we saw symptoms that would reinforce a general shift away from the few publishers who charge excessive prices, and we're trying to collectively reflect on how we could reinforce that shift.
Sounds great. Anyone else in the room during the open access used to be licensing models conversation want to raise something? Peter, do you want to mention anything about if a university said to you, what's the best thing you could do on open access, what would it be? Do you mind passing over, Bob? We have the world expert on the topic right here.
I would say Harvard is doing things in the right order. The best thing a university could do is to require its faculty, with an opt-out, to deposit copies of their peer-reviewed manuscripts in open access repositories. The Harvard Faculty of Arts and Sciences did that, then the law school did that, then the government school did that, and then business school?
Education.
And having done 4 out of the 10 schools and working on the rest, they are now thinking about this fund to pay the publication fees at the open access journals, which charge the fees. I think that's two right policies, and that's the right order in which to consider them. But if your campus wants to do something similar, I would start with the Harvard-style deposit policy to get those peer-reviewed manuscripts into open access repositories. By the way, that's one way to solve the prestige problem as well, because it's a way of publishing in a high-prestige journal, even if it's not open access, and still provide open access to a peer-reviewed version of the manuscript.
Nice, thank you. So just by way of kind of final openings, anybody not get to say something they wanted to say during the course of today? I'm going to use my last word, and then I'll turn it over to Phil, just as a huge thank you to each of you for coming, but most pointedly to, on behalf of the Harvard Law School Library and the Berkman Center, to Amr and the rest of the Berkman staff, Becca Tabaski, and all the people who made this happen. Thank you. This is an extremely hardworking crew, trust me, and they pulled this off despite lots of other demands, so thank you. Professor Malone, the last words.
Thanks. So my first last word is just to echo what John said and to thank the people that worked hard to make this happen. But as importantly, I want to thank all of you, not just for coming and sort of sitting with us all day, but really for digging in and participating and contributing as actively as you did. The vision behind this was that, you know, these are really are some profound questions. We're in a fairly rare moment in copyright law, in access to information, in the nature and future of libraries. And the only way we're going to get something good out of this is if all of us in the positions that we're in really dig in and think hard about not just what we don't like, but how do we make it better? How do we seize this moment and actually turn it into something that's better? So I really appreciate all of you doing the hard work to push us along that path. And I feel like we really did move along that path. And I was struck by the comment early on, which really, I think, captured what we were thinking when we put this together, that we really should think of this as day one. We should think of this as the beginning of whatever it is that we're going to do. And for a lot of us, that whatever it is going to be different. For some people, it seemed pretty clear from what we heard. The thing to do, the action item, is to push hard on motions to intervene and write very compelling amicus briefs and really try to influence the judge to either stop the deal or to change it in ways that different people think are necessary to fit the things that they're concerned with. For other people, depends on which branch of John's decision tree we ultimately end up under. But for some of us, it's if the deal actually goes through more or less as is, then how do we live in that world and operate in that world to make the things that we care about, the kind of broad open access and privacy and so on, a reality beyond the scope of what's in the settlement? If the settlement isn't approved, then how do we do what I think a lot of people wish that we, in the broad sense, had done independently 5 or 10 years ago? So it's a great time to think about all of those things. And I would just end by sort of inviting or encouraging all of us, as we do that, to think boldly. I think this is not a time to think sort of small and think, all right, well, how do we solve this particular problem? And gosh, there's some specific things in the settlement that I wish were different. I mean, that's fine. We need to do that. But I think it's also a time to think very broadly and really to take advantage of what to me seems like, if not a once in a lifetime, certainly a not very often kind of opportunity to really make some fundamental changes in these areas. And I think Larry Lessig, as he always does, put the frame on that right. You know, we can think about, if we take Orphan Works as an example, we can think about how to make some extremely helpful and valuable and yet relatively conventional changes to the Orphan Works law, depending on how this deal goes through and what the influence is. But we can also think about Orphan Works in a very different way. We can say, instead of thinking about who should get the money when we digitize and make available Orphan Works, maybe those works shouldn't be under copyright, maybe they shouldn't be generating money in the first place. How do we have a different system that maybe does the kind of registration and things Larry wants, so that there's a lot broader access to those works, the works that people don't come back and claim without having to worry about copyright and worry about a whole system of Orphan Works. So I think those kind of bold thoughts and bold visions for how we maybe move forward from here, not in small ways, but in big leaps, is what we all should carry with us as we think about our next step. So again, thank you all for coming. Thanks for really pushing us off on day one of these next steps so well. We appreciate it.
And thanks to all those tuned in on the webcast who are not here. So anyway, thank you.
Thanks.